Hello, everyone. This is World Review with Ivo Dalder, a weekly look at news from around the world. Each week, I sit down with leading journalists and experts to break down what's happening in the world, why it matters, and what comes next. Today, it's Saturday, February 14, Valentine's Day. This week, we're coming to you live from Munich, or at least live to tape from Munich, where the world's security elite is gathering this year, as it does every year, to discuss the state of the world, engage in active talks, a little diplomacy, and a lot of eating and drinking. It's been an eventful 48 hours so far, with more to come later tonight and tomorrow, but much has already happened here. To discuss what it all means, I'm joined here in Munich by three journalists who are reporting on this year's Munich Security Conference. Aaron Axelson is the EU correspondent for the Danish newspaper Politiken. Aaron joins us for the first time here. Wonderful to have you.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Steve Erlanger is chief diplomatic correspondent in Europe for the New York Times. Steve, wonderful to have you back in Munich.
Thank you. Willkommen.
Willkommen. Alex Ward is the national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Alex, great to have you back.
Happy to be here.
So let's start with what do you think is the most memorable thing? Alex, let me start with you. What has struck you most?
Well, it's Valentine's Day, so let's talk about love. And right now what I'm finding is there's a jilted partnership between the U.S. and Europe, and more interesting, there's a side romantic conversation happening between Europeans and Democrats, where the Democrats and Europeans are looking at each other and going, hey, we good? Are we all right? Are we okay? Because I'm a little bit worried about my other lover over there. So it's been kind of a group therapy session, a group relationship session, let's call it, here on Valentine's Day. They're trying to find the love again. I think what we're mainly finding in our reporting is, and you've heard this in Secretary Rubio's comments, you know, this sense of tough love. Hey, Europeans, we're only mean to you because we love you, but we're trying to get to this place together. And Democrats sense an opportunity to basically say, hey, you're being jilted. You're being mistreated. We, the Democratic Party, if you know, we were to come back into power, not only in Congress, but in the White House, we might be able to have a more fruitful partnership.
Love between Democrats and Europeans who feel jilted. That's one way to look at it. Karen, what has struck you most in the past 48 hours?
Well, I think as a Dane, of course, I find it very remarkable how many times Denmark and Greenland is mentioned in the debates. It's not surprising, of course, but it's a bit surreal. I just ran into the leader of Greenland, Jens Frederik Nielsen, just before this show. And think about that, this guy could walk around last year's conference without nobody knowing who he was. Literally by himself. And this year he's surrounded by, I don't know how many people, just in the level of Zelensky almost, because everybody wants to speak to this guy, because this is the guy in charge of this big island that Trump wants. So for me, that's, of course, a bit striking.
Yeah, it's a little unreal. The ice mass of 57,000 people. I think the prime minister, he's 34 years old?
He's very young, yes, he's.
Most people probably think he's either a journalist or one of the thousands of security people that are running around here. No, he's the prime minister of the most important country that everybody wants to talk about. It's remarkable. Steve, what have you picked up? What's remarkable for you?
I would say the most important head of a semi-autonomous province, which is Greenland. Well, Macron spoke of a Greenland moment. And I think to some degree, this whole meeting, I call it the Munich Security Circus, it's become so big and so unwieldy, but I think it's been dominated by the European shock still over Trump's behavior in Davos, his speech in Davos, his effort to say, I'm going to have Greenland, whether you like it or not, as a NATO ally. So the Americans came here, I think, to disengage, to de-escalate, no more mockery, no more insults. This, as Alex said, a kind of tough love, but there's a poison pill in the tough love. I mean, the contrast that strikes me, and we can talk more about it, was between Elbridge Colby, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, his talk and Marco Rubio, Secretary of State's speech today, because on the one hand, Colby was fairly realistic about shared interests. We don't care about values, he pretty much said, or we share values with only some people. While for Rubio, this was a speech about values. It was about we need to come together over civilizational values. And I think many Europeans see this as a poison pill. They don't like this. And so this is what struck me, and this effort by the Americans to be nice, to say, let's have a new partnership, but based on what? Western Christian values? What does that say to the European, the rest of Europe? What does it say to America? What does it say to the rest of the world? Those are the questions people are asking.
No, I think fascinating. All three really interesting domestic American politics part that Alex brought up, the Greenland moment, but the Greenland reality in many ways. And I think this dichotomy in the American view, I mean, what struck me most is, if I'd have to sum it up, is if last year this was about America, this year it's about Europe. It's about how is Europe getting together and respond to this, and we'll get into this. I think, looking back, the most important speech was the first one by the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, which had some really tough words. And I think a lot of the themes we talked about already came up here. But let's take this, Steve, your issue on shared values, because clearly it was the Vance attack. And I mean, the most remarkable statement still was not the indictment itself, was, I'm not concerned about Russia as a threat and China as a threat. I'm concerned about, quote, the threat from within, said in Germany the day after he had visited Dachau, which in fact contained many of the people who constituted the threat within. I think, Steve, you and I talked about this on this podcast immediately afterwards, which is a pretty shocking part of that discussion. But Steve's right that there was a slightly different tone from Rubio, not just on the relationship is actually okay and we belong together, he said a couple of times, and our fates are intertwined, which is something, by the way, I've not heard anybody else in the Trump administration say. But there was also this sense that, you know, our values are particular. They're white, coming from Marco Rubio, interesting in and of itself, Christian.
Once in a while, Judeo-Christian, when they remember
that there are Jews, yes, but certainly not people who are from Islamic background or atheists or other, so many others. As a European, Karen, when you listen to this, what does that mean to you? And when you talk to European leaders, what do they think about?
Well, it's clear that most Europeans, they look at Rubio and they think that he's their best friend in the White House. He's the most normal guy in the Trump administration, and you could put your faith into him. From a Danish perspective, that's also why, I mean, we keep saying, okay, we are doing the negotiation over Greenland with this guy, and then means it's a level of common sense in this whole thing, and this whole process. It might end well. But when you actually listen to what he said, as I heard it, he pretty much said the same things as Vance said last year, just in a nicer way, which is also why it surprised me that he got these standing ovations, because let's face it, he was basically saying to the Europeans that you have to do it our way, otherwise we go alone. And if you don't share our view on the world and our values, then you're left by yourself. And is that a message to applaud? I don't know. So when you talk to European leaders, I talk to the Danish leaders, I talk to some foreign ministers and stuff, they say, well, it was a nicer speech, but the message was pretty much the same as last year. I also spoke to the former NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, and that was also his message, saying, look, we're still in the same place as we were last year, that Europe still has to just get there together and be on our own feet, because we cannot depend on the Americans anymore.
I want to get to this dependence issue and what it really means for European politics and where, because of course that is the main theme that everybody is harping on. But this value issue is, Alex, I mean, I think there is the difference between, that Steve pointed out, the difference between the sort of the Colby dance. Colby has the position he has because of his friendship with J.D. Vance, versus the Rubio side. How do you see this? And when you talk to Americans, but also to folks here in the hall, how do they see the difference, or do they say, actually, no, it's just Rubio's just he's just a nicer looking guy, but making the same message.
I agree with what's already been said. It was a very our way or the highway, but couched within a, you know, we have certain values, we have a shared history, you know, so there's a reason we want this relationship to survive, but it can only survive if you do these kinds of things. So I was also surprised with the standing ovation. I guess, you know, Rubio hit the Europeans, but didn't hit him as hard as Vance. So maybe there was an expectation that he would, you know, go the Vance route. The fact that he didn't was sort of the, you know, led to some enjoyment. I would note just, for 2 years in a row now, we've had J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio present the American position, and in neither case did they say the threats we face together are Russia, China, et cetera, et cetera. First, it was the enemy from within, and in this case, it was there's a tension here between us that we need to resolve. The threat that is being defined by the U.S. is one within the relationship. They are not defining the threat as external to the bigger things out there, and so that was, I thought, for me, at least on the geopolitical level, the through line between Vance and Rubio. And frankly, I thought there was more through line than difference in those two speeches.
Yeah, I think that's really an interesting point, Steve. I'm glad you brought that up. I make sense now that you say it. I mean, Colby said the same thing. In fact, he said it even more directly. He said, we have different threats that require us to use our militaries elsewhere. That's why you need to take care of the Russian threat. If you think there's a Russian threat, you should take care of it because we have more important things to do. And so at the core of an alliance is a common threat perception. And in some sense, that's gone.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is the Trump administration doesn't see Ukraine as a national security problem for the United States. I mean, it is for Europe. And the Europeans seem shocked that the Americans feel this way. But that's the way Trump feels. He's kind of bought the Putin narrative that Ukraine's kind of artificial and the West pushed too hard and we should never have offered them NATO membership, even in principle, and that Putin has a point, right? So that's been the Trump position. The difference I heard between Rubio and Vance is Rubio didn't talk about far-right parties. He didn't hit the woke issues. I mean, what shocked people as much about Vance was that he intervened in the middle of a German election campaign.
6 days before.
Yeah, in support of a far-right, to some degree, anti-constitutionalist party. And I think Friedrich Merz remains infuriated about what happened. But you're right. I mean, I did hear Rubio, however, say that the fate of Europe is important to the United States, and Colby was very clear that the American nuclear umbrella would exist and that America was committed to Article 5, and it just wants to see a necessary transition to Europeans taking care of conventional defense. And what struck me about the response, and partly the response to Greenland, is Europeans are all angry about, gee, you know, we've got to do this for ourselves, and we do need some sort of strategic autonomy, and we do need to spend more, and we do need to spend more on defense. That's exactly what the Americans want them to do.
Right, exactly. Talking to this week with Steve Erlanger of the New York Times, Karen Acheson of Politiken, and Alex Ward of the Wall Street Journal. I'm struck that there's one thing that seems to be taken as a given by Europeans and Americans alike, in part because Merz said it, Rubio said it, Carney said it in Davos, and that's the rules-based order is gone. Is American leadership gone? That's probably the case, and Merz said so directly, but are we now living in a world in which there are no more rules? And isn't
part of what the Europeans are rebelling against, and Carney is rebelling against, is in fact that we need to maintain rules-based order, Steve.
Well, I found it very interesting to compare Carney, who couldn't come, unfortunately, because of this horrible high school shooting at home, and Mertz, because Carney at Davos talk of rupture. Now, rupture is a break. That's disorder. Mertz didn't talk about rupture. He talked about a rift. He talked about difficulties. I interpreted his speech as an appeal for repair, to say, yes, the old order is dead. He says that with sadness, but there's no need for nostalgia. But we need to build a better relationship with America. We can have a more resilient alliance that depends on both parties. Trust is hard to restore, but it will be better restored if the Europeans do their own job and do more for their own defense. So I found that a kind of optimistic, relatively optimistic speech, and Mertz being very careful not to speak of rupture, because I think Germans and many Europeans think rupture is strategically stupid and dangerous.
I think that's right, although Mertz was very, very strong on the issue of values. And
absolutely. I mean, there were lots to be critical about, but I mean,
the rupture rift distinction that you're making, and I like, you know, now we have the three R's, the repair, I mean, by part of that, neither rupture nor rift, just repair. Alex, what do you think about this rules-based order issue? I'm just struck that people are throwing something that really is guided, at least Western policy, for 80 years under the bus.
I think there's two interrelated laments. Number one is the dismantling of the old order was an inside job, right? It used to be that there was the belief was it would be some sort of other power that would overtake what existed. Instead, it was the United States that went, this isn't working for us anymore for some legitimate reasons, let's be honest, but overall not handled in the most deftest way, let's say, which leads to lament number two, which is, fine, America, you don't think this is working for you. What comes next? And that is still unclear. They're literally building the order plane while they're flying it, to mix a metaphor, I guess. So this is, I think, what we're finding here, is that what the Trump administration is proposing is a sense of disorder of, we've got our own priorities, you've got your priorities. While there are historical links and while there's friendship and partnership, you know, we can go our own separate ways if need be. Whereas the Europeans are going, okay, but there's a way we can figure this out together. And there, right now, the U.S. is giving Europe the stiff arm. So, which is driving them into the arms of the Democrats, at least at this conference. So what I'm finding and what I suspect is happening is there's now this, you know, you can't really fix a problem unless you name it. And for the first time in these first months of 2026, they're naming the problem, which is that order does not exist. Now we're beating the conversations of what follows, and whether it's rupture or repair, or, well, I guess rupture implies you need something completely new. Repair implies you're revitalizing. That is now the sort of meta debate above all these other things we're talking about. And which brings me to the Greenland point that you know better than I do. But I think it just became such a kind of avatar for the moment. Like, the United States is going after Greenland? I mean, if you were looking for a sort of an epitaph for that order, you couldn't find a sort of greater little moment.
I think that's true, except that, of course, the defense and the European anger and surprise and the way they acted was to say, no, this is against the order that we built, and we're not taking that. So in that sense, I would argue that the Europeans are trying to defend the rules-based order against what they now see as the biggest disruptor. And we are at the Munich Security Conference, in which the annual report talks about the great disruption and the ultimate disruption and wrecking ball diplomacy. All of that's true. But that doesn't mean the order is dead.
No, I agree that I find the Europeans are fighting for a rule-based order, but it might be another rule-based order than the one we know right now, because they all say the same thing, that the old order is dead. You're completely right. But they're not saying that we have to live without order. We have to live in disorder, because that only serves Trump and Putin and other big giants. So, and then we're back to Carney's call for the middle powers and need to step in. And they're all looking for new alliances, new ways to work through this mess the world is in right now. And as you said before, I don't think there are any answers right now on where we're going to end this. But for the Europeans and for the small countries like a small country like Denmark, we have absolutely no interest in a world without orders. We need some rules to guide our way forward, and we will fight for some kind of world-based order, rule-based order, sorry. But what it's going to look like, it's very difficult to say.
I think Europe should be fighting a lot harder for it. I mean, the rules-based order is what the EU lives on. It's part of the DNA. I mean, it's why little countries don't get eaten by big countries, as Trump tried to do with Greenland. I mean, the whole idea of the European Union is to make sure that small countries have a vote and a voice and are protected, that borders are sovereign, that you don't change them by force. This is worth fighting for. And the UN is worth fighting for, too. I mean, you know, this Board of Peace thing, I'm glad no senior European has signed up for it. But if they abandon the UN, given its whatever problems it has, that will let China take it over. And I don't think that's a great idea. So I would like to see the Europeans fight back harder to say we can help protect, even if it's and it'll be attractive to the rest of the world. One of the things about the American push for this cultural values thing is it's basically says to the rest of the world, the non-white Christian European world, we're not interested in you. You're not our partners, which I find rather shocking and a bit racist as well.
Yeah, no, I think. I'm 100% with you, and I like the way, Karen, you put it, that they're still fighting for a rules-based order. The rules-based order that's gone is Pax Americana. It's the American-led global order. But that's not the only rules-based order that exists. You can have other ones. And I think the Europeans are about to make a huge mistake by not fighting hard for it, because who's still in the vacuum of the American leadership? The Chinese are doing it at the UN. They're doing it in WHO. But these organizations shouldn't be Chinese run. They should be run by us, by the Western people who still care about it. It struck me that this is a debate worth having. And by saying it's dead, you're really not saying what it is that needs to replace it or how it needs to be changed, Alex.
But just to bring down the aperture or close the aperture for a little bit, what's interesting is that it's now been 10-ish or so years, a decade in which no American politician has really been able to make the case of why the rules-based order works for everyday Americans. Not to say that there isn't an argument to make, just that they've really struggled to get that argument across. And obviously Trump came in the 2015-2016 timeframe, said in his own way, this ain't working. People bought into it. Joe Biden comes along, makes a case to say, well, there is some value, but even he was tweaking at the margins. And now Trump comes back again. And still, when you hear Democrats here or even other Republicans, the case that they're making is, you know, let's blow this up in some way. I would say Americans aren't pushing hard enough, but American leaders aren't pushing hard enough, but they aren't able to make a case. Nothing is really breaking through to now. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, who, is making a splash and is considered a 2028 contender. She's now talking about a foreign policy for the working class. Frankly, I don't know what it means, but this is a new attempt to kind of reframe this debate that Biden tried with foreign policy for the middle class. So she changed working class.
And we are having a foreign policy for the upper class, for the Pluto class. So, you know, that makes sense, right?
So, yeah, so all this. So it's the change of one word's fine. Okay. But there's a lack of ideas everyone seems to be devoid of a plan to make the case. Now, maybe there is no case to be made. Let's be very pessimistic. Maybe the American population is really said, hey, this really hasn't worked out. We do need a new compact. Fine. But even then, no one has the big idea what that new compact is.
So it's interesting because, of course, the Biden administration tried to make the case for the rule-based order about more than anybody else. Tony Blinken wouldn't give a speech without talking about the rules-based order. But I agree, it didn't resonate. Interestingly enough, if you look at polling of Americans, which in my old hat in the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, we used to do, still do, a new poll just came out. When you define what the rules-based, you know, when you look at the components of the rules-based order, alliances, support for democracy, human rights, free trade, Americans overwhelmingly support. So it's a question, I think it's a communication question. And the rules-based order is probably the wrong, or even liberal international order is probably the wrong way to talk about it. But talking about alliances, talking about free trade, and those issues, it seemed to resonate with America.
Just one super quick anecdote. When I was covering the 2020, the latest presidential election, one Republican was, I won't say his name, but he was talking about the foreign policy he'd like to see. And I said, oh, that's the liberal international order that you're trying to defend. He goes, oh, I don't like that because the word liberal. Can we call it the conservative international order?
But maybe this is a very healthy debate, because let's face it, Europe has been in a very naive place until recently, just believing in the American world-based order, that you took care of our security, we could get by our gas in Russia. So it's maybe it's a good wake-up call. Maybe it's healthy for us to start discussing what values do we actually want to defend, and how do we do it, and how do we want to stand up for ourselves? It's about time we do it instead of just buying in on the American model, which I think we have been doing for too many years.
We're talking here in Munich about the discussion in Munich Security Conference, and it's going well beyond that, which is great, with Carol Axison of Politiken, Steve Erlanger of the New York Times, and Alex Ward of the Wall Street Journal. I want to shift to Ukraine. Because I'm struck that Ukraine, other than the hour that Zelensky was on stage, which I thought was interesting, where he apologized and thanked and thanked and thanked and thanked. And I guess the Davos speech didn't go over very well when he blamed and blamed and blamed and blamed. Although I'll tell a little anecdote later about this. But it didn't appear in the Rubio address. Colby didn't talk about it. Frankly, other than sort of we need a just and sustainable peace, nobody else seems to talk about Ukraine in some way. Steve, did you see it that way, or was Ukraine just the subtext?
Well, Ukraine was put à la côté. It was put on the side because no one knows what to do. Everyone's waiting for Witkoff and, you know, I mean, the Europeans are negotiating. They have a seat at the table, but they're negotiating with the Americans. And then we'll see what Putin has to say, which is probably no. So we turn ourselves upside down over notions of security assurances, guarantees a stupid word, but, you know, a reassurance force, what would the Americans do, blah, 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 when the big issue is how you get Putin to agree to end the war and on what terms. And that's, no one has the answer for that. I did just hear Boris Pistorius, the German defense minister, Radek Sikorski, the Polish foreign minister, and others, including Elisa Slotkin, the American senator from Michigan, talk about Ukraine on a main panel, but in a slightly frustrated way. It's the usual, we're there to support Ukraine, we can't let Russia win, we need to keep supporting Ukraine, but my question always has been, Europe says it's committed to supporting Ukraine, but it has no strategy for ending the war itself, certainly not without Donald Trump putting pressure on Putin, which he so far hasn't been willing to do. Now, that may change a little bit with more sanctions and so on. I mean, Trump tends to get very frustrated, but I think most people think the war is going to just keep going on for another year or so. Who knows? And everyone kind of dreams of, you know, this Russian collapse, the economy collapsing. They're strained. There's no question. Everyone says they lost 30,000 dead in the month of December, which is an enormous figure if true.
I think it's 30,000 people removed from the battlefield, either dead or severely wounded.
I mean, Rutte, sorry, they all talk about it in slightly different ways. Yeah. for Putin, this, I mean, he can't lose this war. This is for him, this is his whole legacy. This is his political life at this point. So there has been talk, but there hasn't been many answers. I think there's quite a lot of despair. I went to the Ukrainian lunch today, which is always a big deal. And you had very smart people, including the Czech president, the former NATO general, Pavel, who had a very good line. He said, you know, a quick end to the war won't win a Nobel Prize. It will produce another war.
So, great line. Alex, what struck you on Ukraine? It's either more of the same in the way that I think Steve has said, with not a lot of innovation here, but also there wasn't a lot. I mean, Rubio didn't show up at the meeting with the leaders and which I thought was kind of strange. I think the leaders thought it was kind of strange, the meeting with Zelensky.
It's starting to look like the U.S. has lost interest. They've threatened to lose interest many times. At this point, it feels like they're voting with their feet. I mean, Trump, of course, if he could get the deal of his dreams, he will do it. They will push for it. But at this point, the feeling is there's an impasse. And the impasse seems to be, oddly enough, about sequencing. Usually in diplomacy, you would know, those last couple lines matter the most. But in this case, there seem to be agreements on those security guarantees, assurances, however you want to call them. There's no agreement on the territory or really where to draw the lines, let's say. And Zelensky's being very clear about what his desire is. He goes, give me the guarantees first, then I'll talk about that other stuff, which is, of course, is important. Russia's not engaging in good faith, but they're around. And then you've got Trump, who just wants, as he always does, the big deal. He wants the one big, beautiful Russia-Ukraine deal, which he's not going to get. And he's using the security guarantees discussion as kind of some weird leverage on Zelensky, which is not working. So we're all in this weird dead space, this impasse, and that's making Trump lose interest. And right now he's got the Iran to worry about. And that's where his mind seems to be. Plus the midterms are coming up and everyone at the White House wants him to focus on domestic issues. And while he's pushing his team to get a deal by June, I don't really see that he's actually pushing for a deal by June. It's different to tell his team to get it done versus actually doing stuff to get it done. So we're very much in a limbo, and of course that's horrible for the people that are suffering in Ukraine.
Karen, what had struck you on the Ukraine issue here on Munich?
Well, I'm struck by the fact that that the debate about Greenland has been overshadowing the Ukraine war, at least in Denmark, of course, but also in big parts of Europe. And because we're talking about big ideals being crushed by the Americans. And we tend to forget that the Ukrainians are fighting almost 4 years now for our values. And when we talk about it, we talk about, yeah, we have to still support them. And it's cold now because it's winter. They have no energy. But we forget to talk about why we have to support them. I mean, then we're back to the discussion about values. I mean, why is it important? What are they fighting for? Why are they defending our world, our Europe, our values? And if you have to keep reminding the Europeans about that, because Ukraine seems so far away from the Danes' everyday life and now also very far away from the American daily life, of course. So I think that's worrying. And it must be hard for Zelensky to show up here in year four and say, you know, I'm still here, I'm still talking freely, and I'm still fighting for my country. But as you say, we're in an impasse. What's next?
And that act, I'm not blaming Zelensky at all. He has to come and he has to say thank you and he has to push and push and push. But the act wears thin at some point because it's been years of this now. And you know, his ability to sort of appeal and make a kind of drama into the theater of global politics, he doesn't have that superpower anymore. And so now, as much as he's still doing what he needs to do to go around the world and appeal for weapons and support, without the engagement of the Trump administration, you know, or without, including with this rupture, rift, whatever you want to call it, between the U.S. and Europe, he just doesn't really have that audience to perform for as much as he used to. I don't want to give the Trump administration too short shrift. I mean, they've gotten the Russians and the Ukrainians in a room together, and that's something, but it feels more like window dressing than any real progress. But, you know, it's not like they're doing nothing, but what they are doing does not seem to be working.
I met with the defense minister who I've met at year ago, European defense minister. He said, so a year ago, you were really pessimistic about Ukraine. So how do you feel now? I said, oh, worse. because we have spent, I said, what we've seen is a year of everybody in a massive effort to massage one person's ego. They're certainly not trying to find a way to end this war, because that's not what this is about. We know how the war ends. It's when the Russians or the Ukrainians say, we can't or don't want to fight anymore. That's when the war ends. That's how all wars end. It doesn't end because Donald Trump wants it to end, but they don't want to be blamed for, you know, the Ukrainians don't want to be blamed for the failure to end the war. Russians seem to be a little less worried about that, but even they are engaged in that. And the Europeans don't want to be blamed for all of this. Fascinating sort of way. I wanted one final question to get out, because we did talk a little bit about Macron and we talked about Merz, but I want to talk about the European leaders. How did they do? This was a big moment in some ways for each of them. When you look at all the big speeches that were out there, there were a bunch of them. Who do you think sort of met the mark, made the speech that was necessary to make? Now, we all know it's just a speech. Follow up is important, but the speeches in themselves set the tone for the ability to follow up. Karen.
I definitely found the speech of Friedrich Merz the best and strongest speech, because he was very straightforward. And I think for him, being a transatlantist and being a conservative, for him it was a big step taking this fight up against the U.S. on values and on the Europe has to stand firm in its own right and stuff. But still, I mean, he's not that experienced in the European diplomacy yet. So seeing him as, you know, speaking on behalf of the whole of Europe and performing on behalf of the whole of Europe, it's a bit difficult to see for the moment. Macron is used to be better at that, but he's so weak for the moment. So we are still in search of a very strong leader. And I guess von der Leyen is the one that is doing best operationally for the moment. But is she a strong leader, a strong face? Not when she meets Trump, that's for sure.
Well, I would say, as Stalin once said of the Pope, how many divisions does Ursula von der Leyen have? Macron did his thing, right?
In English.
He did, and quite good English.
And without sunglasses.
Without sunglasses, his eyes are better. But it was a pep talk for the Europeans. Right. It's basically a pep talk. And it's same old themes. I mean, to some degree, I think of him as Cassandra. I mean, in 2017, in the Sorbonne speech, he said, Europe's got to do more strategic autonomy. The Americans are changing structurally. And then Biden got elected and he looked very disappointed, you know, because in a way it cut the air out of this. Now Trump's back and he's getting his strategic autonomy when he's at his weakest point. And when the Germans are spending all this money and the French don't have the money to spend and the Brits don't have the money to spend. So I think almost by default, it's Friedrich Merz who has a much longer tenure to come. Everyone's worried about the French far right winning the presidency next year, which is, you know, that's a nuclear power. That's a UN Security Council member. So I think Merz plays a very important role. And I thought his speech, again, was pretty good because he was very careful to say, we don't agree on these issues, but we need the Americans and we need to repair this relationship because it is in our interests and their interests. So in some sense, Macron's getting his strategic autonomy, but with a German accent.
All right. Well, we're keeping that one. That's a good one. Strategic autonomy with a German accent. Alex.
Yeah, I mean, conceding as we have that the Europeans probably need to fight harder, I am struck that generally speaking, the Europeans have learned to speak in a way that criticizes the U.S. without fully enraging the White House. Where in the first term it was kind of, no, Mr. President, the rules-based order is such and things go this way. Now it's very much, hey, you know, Donald, all good. See where you're coming from, buddy. But actually, we're worried about the way things are headed. Can we have conversations? Not to say that it's working necessarily, but it is a bit more effective. And the messaging is certainly getting out there in a way that it didn't really resonate as much in the first term. So what does that amount to anything? I like you am more about actions than words. But it is fascinating to me that now in these first 2 months, but particularly over the last year, the Europeans have found their narrative footing. If you're using French words in a German accent, that shows that at least there's some coordination, which we'll take. But is there a point where Trump actually is paying attention and that these pushbacks end up causing him pain? I'm not sure. But for the moment, this campaign, let's call it, is gaining some legs.
I think that's right. I think there's more European cohesion and coherence. I think Starmer's speech, actually, from a British perspective, was very important. It was very important to sort of place him back in the European center stage as part of that. So, in many ways, everybody is coming around to understanding that this is real, and that therefore they need to move on. I think the rest of 2026 is going to be seen whether the rhetoric could turn into reality. So that's what we're going to be watching in the future. We have to leave it here. What a great conversation. I want to thank Karen Axis and Politiken, Steve Erlanger of the New York Times, Alex Ward of the Wall Street Journal. Terrific insights as always. Looking forward to having all of you back. And thank you for listening. World Review is a Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs podcast from Harvard's Kennedy School. This week's episode was produced by Tectonic Video. I am Ivo Dalder. We'll be back next week with another edition of World Review. In the meantime, all have a fantastic week ahead. Thank you all.